this 22nd edition of the Becoming Human in the Cosmos podcast, based on the book of the same title on Amazon. This podcast will center on the 10th chapter, part 2, titled Our Greatest Teachers, Our Best Friends. To finish with the theme carried over from part 1, let's take a look at another aspect of it as an introduction to the next set of ideas. I ask the listener to hear carefully. It contains potentially emotionally charged themes, and I solemnly request that you hear this in the limitations of the context I shall provide. Let's think in terms of a test, and only in terms of a test. A college professor has two classes of 100 students. In all things, the two classes are equal. He gives each a final exam, but there are two versions. In the first version, nearly everyone passes. In the second version, nearly everyone flunks. Which of the two tests was the harder? The one where the majority flunked, of course. Now consider the Jews of the Holocaust versus the Nazis as they stand before God to be judged. Which of the two groups had the easier test? Or which of the two will have the most people who can stand before God and not feel extreme shame and humiliation as their mortal records are examined for all the cosmos to see? I'd say most of the Jews passed their tests of humiliation, subjugation, dehumanization, starvation, maltreatment, and ultimately death. Most of the Nazis flunked their different test of power, prestige, wealth, and no accountability. Am I saying the Nazis had a harder time of it than the Jews in the Holocaust? No. I'm saying the tests of power, prestige, wealth, and no accountability flunk far more people than the tests the Jews went through. I'm not saying either group was made up of better people. The only consideration here is the two types of test and their effect on humans. Professor Nibley illustrates this theme in Nibley on the Timely and the Timeless, page 90. Quote, a favorite theme of Brigham Young was that the dominion God gives man is designed to test him, to enable him to show to himself, his fellows, and all the heavens just how he would act if entrusted with God's own power. If he does not act in a godlike manner, he will never be entrusted with the creation of his own worlds without end. So there is a risk involved. If that rule is ever exercised in an arbitrary or arrogant manner, it is quickly taken away and given to someone else. Note, quickly taken away. The Nazis were in power only 12 years. 12 long, long years to be sure for their victims, but not even a generation, not even a lifetime. Their actions, as described by Dr. Jordan Peterson, previously cited, quote, are so intrinsically terrible that they run counter to the proper nature of human being. These are evil actions. No excuses are available for engaging in them. To dehumanize a fellow being, to reduce him or her to the status of a parasite, to torture and to slaughter with no consideration of individual innocence or guilt, to make an art form of pain, that is wrong. Page 197. And not just the Nazis, I add, but those functioning under communist governments in the 20th century, as detailed in Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago. In a class at Brigham Young University, Nibley made these observations on power. He's quoting from comments made by a presidential campaign manager prior to 1993 on the seductions of power. Quote, running for president feels exactly like being president. The ordinary experiences of life melt away, are replaced by a constant swirl of limousines and money, jet planes and prepared statements, Secret Service men and gorgeous political groupies. There is almost an infinite sense of power and prestige. It feels wonderful. I particularly remember the feeling of riding alone in the limousine with a motorcycle escort. Everybody was peering in at me. To them, I was a blur, power in motion. To me, they were a frozen milieu of still, dumb, gawking faces. That's us, folks. I succumbed to the atrocious assumption that I was more important than other people. If your repeated experience is that you're in motion and everyone else is frozen on the side of the road, it is only reasonable to conclude that you are a more important person than they, that they expect you to run the universe for them. You feel as though you are intelligently responding to empirical evidence, and that is power's greatest corruption. The tragic and universal misconception by the wielder of power that it isn't corrupting them. Lord Acton spoke truly. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Nibley adds his own thoughts, quote, "Who can handle these things? If you are going into the eternities to rule and reign forever, you can't go on with a defect like this. As a mortal, you are here to be tested. This life is a time of probation. This is the hardest test of all. Can you be trusted for infinity? This means, can you be left completely alone for endless ages without doing infinite damage? Well, who can? You make the average person a president of a committee of three, and he starts acting like Genghis Khan. I've seen that happen again and again." Nibley, Teachings of the Book of Mormon, Semester 2, pages 232-233. "I would say there was at least one who could. George Washington. Seriously. When we had finished our Revolutionary War, and he could have been king, or at least president for life of our country, he limited himself to two terms in office, saying, 'I didn't fight George III to become George I. Though a man of incredible austerity and commanding presence, he also had the humility and character to avoid the temptations of power to dictatorship. What a man. I truly believe he was a special gift from God to get the United States up and running. Consider those nations formed by revolution that didn't have a Washington. The French Revolution, hard on the heels of ours, descended into internecine chaos and bloodshed under Marat and Robespierre. The Russian Revolution had the same history with Lenin and Stalin, as did China and Cuba with Mao and Castro, not to mention Pol Pot in Cambodia. At last, I note the campaign manager's comments on the still, dumb, gawking faces who expect you to run the universe for them. That's us, folks. There's a human nature here that needs to be dealt with. Can we change this to benefit our political system? I think it will be harder to change the politicians and power brokers who see us as still, dumb, and gawking than it might be to change our own selves. The drug of power is more powerful than crack cocaine or methamphetamine. We, on the outside looking in, must turn our faces away from these people and cease being still, dumb, and gawking. What an insult to the population. But is that possible? How many of us watch reality, celebrity-based TV slavishly? I sigh for our race. We are a most benighted species. And as to the test the Jews suffered, many near-death experiencers say that our hardest trials are our best friends and teachers. As you face your trials, remember which kind of test ruins the most people. If your trials are with wealth, fame, power, and the like, beware. Far more people are ruined by these tests than the inquisitions of poverty, hunger, humiliation, dehumanization, fear, and the many other trials that were part of the Holocaust. And if I had my druthers, I'd prefer, in my mortal weakness, to be tested by power, wealth, and no accountability, as opposed to hunger, deprivation, loss of freedom, and the like. But knowing my immature soul, I'd probably come off the worse. Think of the sad stories of lottery winners and how they blow through their fortunes and wind up worse off than they were. The great majority of humanity simply can't handle wealth, fame, or power. The material distractions of this world have long been a subject for philosophers. In Aristophanes' last play, The Pluto, we find Hermes, messenger of Zeus, coming to Earth to lambaste us for giving in to the lure of riches and material wealth. Hermes, however, is soon convinced of the good life that Pluto, Satan, has to offer, and changes sides, getting a job with Pluto. Next, the high priest of Zeus, finding himself unemployed, gets in line to get a job with Pluto, and who is sitting in the front office? Zeus himself. It's a cynical observation that no one, not even the highest god in the Greek pantheon, can resist the lure of the material world. In the summer of 08, I heard on Dennis Prager's radio show a story of an attorney, a certain Mr. Scruggs, who had made billions in the tobacco class action lawsuits. Apparently, he had been convicted of trying to bribe a judge in a certain case. Imagine, this guy is a billionaire, and that's not enough. He has to try to bribe a judge to get more. French essayist Michel de Montaigne truly observed, quote, "It is not want, but rather abundance, that breeds avarice." The Complete Essays of Montaigne, page 43. We must deal with the distractions that cause us to look away from the target, largely but not exclusively the material world. In Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Solzhenitsyn, previously cited, teaches us of the curse of material baggage, which in the Gulag, the Russian prison system, where he was quickly filched by the ubiquitous thieves. Quote, "And keep as few things as possible, so that you don't have to fear for them," end quote. He continues, "And don't wear new boots, and don't wear fashionable Oxfords, and don't wear a woolen suit. These things are going to be stolen, taken away, swept aside. Give them up without a struggle, because otherwise the humiliation will poison your heart. By owning things and trembling about their fate, aren't you forfeiting the rare opportunity of observing and understanding?" He goes on to point out that the thieves don't own them for long either. They'll lose them gambling, and these things will all disappear until all are at once again raggedy and equal. Quote, "You were too slow about it. You didn't eat up your fat bacon. You didn't share your sugar and tobacco with your friends. And so now the thieves empty your bindle in order to correct your moral error." In this, we see how God uses thieves to teach us lessons. The thieves, true, are also children of God, but are on a different learning track because of spiritual immaturity. Remember earlier that family of 10 children, ranging in age from infant to late teen? People of these immature classes are part of our trials and tests. How did we deal with our younger siblings when we were in a family? If we had them, I was an only child, so it's easy for me to speculate. And we may cry out and say, "It's not fair." Of course it's not. But fairness in this life is hard to come by, and any adult spirit should know that by now. The question is not whether it's fair, but how do we handle it? How do we grow from it? Fair will be worked out later, after we've died. More Solzhenitsyn, quote, "Own nothing, possess nothing. Buddha and Christ taught us this, and the Stoics and the Cynics. Greedy though we are, why can't we seem to grasp that simple teaching? Can't we understand that with property we destroy our soul? And did they give us a 2-day supply of bread and sugar? In that case, eat it in one sitting. Then no one will steal it from you, and you won't have to worry about it, and you'll be free as a bird in heaven," previously cited. Continuing, "Own only what you can always carry with you. no languages, no countries, no people. Let your memory be your travel bag. Use your memory. It is those bitter seeds alone which might sprout and grow someday. Look around you. There are people around you. Maybe you will remember one of them all of your life and later eat your heart out because you didn't make use of the opportunity to ask him questions. And the less you talk, the more you will hear. Pages 515 through 517. In Volume 2, Solzhenitsyn emphasizes this concept. Quote, "The general loss of eternal freedom for a person with a rich inner world is less hard to bear than for a person who is immature, who lives more in terms of the flesh. When the body is confined, what broad horizons are opened to the mind and the soul." Pages 630 through 631, previously cited. One thinks of the late Stephen Hawking, whose body was confined in, to us, the most horrible of prisons. Yet his mind, free to roam the cosmos, ferreted out many of the secrets of time and space. Yes, I own a home. Yes, I own a car. Yes, I own a computer and the furnishings necessary for a comfortable life. Solzhenitsyn was in the gulag where these things are impossible. The point is, I think, to what degree do these things control and influence our lives, causing us to miss the real stuff in life to cling to, as Jimmy Durante put it in his classic song, Make Someone Happy. Again, balance. And now, one of my favorite stories. There was a man who dearly loved gold. He was a good man in all respects, just a gold finger without the evil. Every day, three times a day, he offered the same prayer. God, I know we can't take it with us, but I love my gold so much, can you grant me a special exception to the rule that, when I die, I can bring my gold with me? Finally, on his 70th birthday, the angel of death appears to him and says, God has heard your prayer. You have 24 hours to convert everything you have into gold, put it in a suitcase, and be ready to pass across. Our hero is overjoyed. He spends all the next day selling his goods and buying gold bullion, coin, and dust. As he's packing the last speck of it into his bulging suitcase, the angel appears, and he goes through that tunnel to the being of light, suitcase in hand. Dragging his gold, he approaches St. Peter, who looks up from the Book of Life and asks, Wait, what's that? You can't bring that in with you. Our boy says, Check your records. I was granted a special exemption. St. Peter looks in the book, mutters something about computers, and says, Well, I'll be darned. You can bring your gold in with you. That's a new one on me. Our hero, huffing and puffing, drags his suitcase full of gold through the pearly gates. And St. Peter, scratching his head and looking on, says, You know, though, for the life of me, I can't figure out why anyone would want to bring a suitcase full of paving material into heaven. Yes, my friends, what may be gold to us here is only paving material there. We need to ask ourselves, what am I taking back? And once again, can we see the eschatological outlook from chapter 1 in operation here? Other negative aspects of the luxury that comes with wealth, as pointed out by Paul Theroux, Ghost Train to the Eastern Star, page 18, quote, Luxury is the enemy of observation. Luxury spoils and infantilizes you and prevents you from knowing the world, end quote. Well, Solzhenitsyn said much the same. It's interesting to me how these great thinkers all come to the same conclusions. Famed 17th century philosopher Spinoza taught of the problems of riches, honor, and sensual indulgence in distracting us from our eternal goals. Runes, Treasury of Philosophy, pages 1131 through 33. Quote, Finally, honor is a great hindrance to us, because it is necessary, if we would attain to it, to direct our lives according to the notions of men, that is to say, by avoiding what they commonly avoid and seeking what they commonly seek, Emerson quoted earlier, said much the same. One cannot be free if one seeks riches and honor. But Spinoza advocates balance, as I have elsewhere. Quote, I came to see that the acquisition of wealth or sensual desire and love of honor are injurious so long as they are sought for their own sake and not as means for other things. But if they are sought as means, they will be enjoyed in moderation and will not be injurious. On the contrary, they will be very conducive to the end for which they are sought. End quote. In other words, sensual desire is fine when it is present in a marriage to knit in intimacy and joy the hearts of a man and a woman. Wealth, or at least a comfortable living, free from modest want, contributes to a special atmosphere in which greater spiritual goods can be pursued. And honor? Well, let God be the judge of that. So many people who are currently honored in this life will be the bigger jerks in the eternities, and so many people who will never have their names in the news will be those crowned with eternal glory, as the intelligent beings of the cosmos know their true lives and stories. Eschatology, my friends, eschatology. Carl Jung, previously cited, states, quote, we wholly overlook the essential fact that the achievements which society rewards are won at the cost of a diminution of personality. Many, far too many, aspects of life which should also have been experienced lie in the lumber room among dusty memories. Sometimes even they are glowing coals under gray ashes. Page 104. Quote, but love for an object eternal and infinite feeds the mind with joy alone, and a joy which is free from all sorrow. This is something greatly to be desired and to be sought with all our strength. Spinoza. So according to Spinoza, there are objects to be loved which can bring joy to us, but he uses the adjectives eternal and infinite to describe these objects. Certainly, then, the love of a shiny car, a nice home, a collection of stamps, doesn't come under that heading, for none of these things are eternal and infinite. God fills that description, so do his children, and learning to love is one of the purposes of life that is universal and will be discussed in the last chapter. Fashion is a good example of our hang-ups over temporal and irrelevant things in Heavenly Answers to Earthly Questions. Previously cited, Joyce H. Brown shares what she learned from her near-death experience regarding fashion and style. Quote, fashions and standards of beauty changed over the years. Glimpses were shown me of men and women who desired to be in style and in vogue with fashions that changed with the whims of their time. I knew that they sacrificed important things in their lives for fancy clothes, jewelry, and other material things to stay at the height of whatever was considered the in thing at the time. It seemed silly to me from my other side viewpoint, and I learned how important it was to keep a balance. Priorities needed to be grounded by an eternal perspective of heavenly treasures that did not wear out or go out of style. After people who had been caught up in fashion trends passed on to the other side, they became aware of the foolishness of their behavior. They were disappointed in themselves for wasting their time and resources on frivolous earthly things when they found out that people and family were so much more important than things. Pages 132 through 134. So the Jews and the rest of us have much to learn to be prepared to function in the cosmos. In the previous chapter, I detailed the complexity of creating a cosmos and an earth that could support life. The life it supports, our spiritual and intellectual life, as well as physical, is no less complex. Indeed, it may be even more so. How to sort all this out and get a running start on the task ahead of all of us is my final goal for this book. Good luck to all of us. It helps to have a near-death summation to put things in perspective. Quote, Earth life is designed as a university, a school, where we learn from our choices and our mortal experiences. I recognized that my most painful experiences taught me the most. Joyce Brown, previously cited, page 72. And thus we conclude this 22nd podcast of the series, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, based on the book I have on Amazon of that same title. The next podcast will be titled, Becoming Human in the Cosmos, Part 1, and will deal with the development of the human being and the final, or 11th, chapter. Join me, please, and thanks for tuning in, and special thanks to Craig and Kate Whitmore, my technical personnel, without whom this podcast and my website wouldn't even exist in the cloud as a dust particles. Visit our website at hazelleproductions.com, hazelleproductions.com. Thank you.